A scary incident yesterday on JetBlue Flight 191 when passengers saw a disturbed pilot locked out of the cockpit, shouting about a bomb on board and forcibly restrained by air crew and passengers.
He kept pointing at me and said, you know, you need to pray. As soon as he pointed at me, I grabbed his arm and I put him in a chokehold.
That tape from ABC News. The plane landed safely, and the pilot, identified as a 20-year veteran, was taken to a hospital for medical observation. The airline suspended him earlier today. Pilots, aircrew, when do you start to ask questions about a crew member's behavior, especially when it's the captain? Call and tell us what we don't know about what happens in the cockpit. 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. John Cox is a retired pilot with 25 years' experience with U.S. Airways and now the CEO of Safety Operating Systems, an airline safety consulting firm. He writes the Ask the Captain column for USA Today and joins us from a studio at the Poynter Institute in St. Petersburg. Nice to have you with us today.
Good to be with you, Neil.
And that's a remarkable situation where a co-pilot has to forcibly eject the pilot from the cockpit.
It is. In 40 years of being around commercial aviation, I don't think I can remember another situation quite like this one.
And it's not to suggest that they are in any way common or that in any way pilots or air crew are in any way more or less vulnerable to heart attacks or erratic behavior as anybody else, but it's not the situation where you're at 35,000 feet.
Well, what we're really dealing with here is a pilot or crew member incapacitation. And flight crews do deal with that from time to time. We have crew members around the world. The most common cause for crew member incapacitation is food poisoning. But the difference here, of course, is that a food poisoned flight crew member typically is not ambulatory and is not posing, is not acting inappropriately. But the same sorts of policies and procedures would apply for any sort of incapacitation event, and that's what we had yesterday.
There is, though, a chain of command. No, the captain is the captain. He's in charge.
He absolutely is in charge until the point at which he or she can no longer function and becomes incapacitated. At that point, there is a very clear line of succession with the first officer, then assuming the job of being pilot in command.
And how does the co-pilot, the first officer, start the questioning process to say, Captain, I'm not sure you can go on?
Well, I think first it's not so much the questioning as the seeing that there is unexpected, unacceptable behavior that could be the result of a variety of things. I mean, we've seen people have cardiac events. We've seen people that have had seizures on occasion. Those are inappropriate events. And once you start to realize that you may have a pending or unfolding incapacitation event, that's when the recognition of how to handle it occurs. And pilots are trained to deal with that in cooperation with the flight attendants. This is all under crew resource management, and utilizing the entire flight crew as a team gives you a much greater likelihood of a successful outcome. And that's what happened on JetBlue yesterday.
Well, clearly the pilot, as he said, as we heard him say, was distraught and had crossed the line. But it builds up to that. We don't know what happened in the cockpit before that.
That's just it. We don't know what happened. We do know that at some point, everybody that was satisfied with each other when they departed, when they showed up for the trip, they got on the airplane. No one refused to fly. No one raised questions about the competency or the ability of any of the crew members to complete their fulfilled jobs. So as the flight unfolded, things changed. The incapacitation became more obvious, and the crew responded to it.
You mentioned flight attendants. Some of the bigger jets, I guess there's still a flight engineer on board, so there's a third person in the cockpit as well. But people lower down in the pecking order, is there a procedure by which they can raise questions?
Absolutely. There are very few flight engineers left today. With the automation and modern jets, it's typically a captain, a first officer. On the longer flights, there may be an additional first officer, or in some cases, in the very ultra-long flights, two full crews. But there is a line of succession, and if in today's world utilizing this crew resource management. That is something that pilots and flight attendants oftentimes train together so that they, the ability to create this team to face an abnormality, whatever it may be, is enhanced. And this is, in the case of a crew member incapacitation, that would be the policies and procedures that they would turn to.
Do air crews fly together? I mean, obviously, the flight attendants are rotated around, I think, quite a bit. But would the first officer and the captain fly together a lot?
Usually, a captain and a first officer will fly together, but they may rotate in and out depending on schedule demands.
So they get to know each other pretty well.
Yes, you get to know somebody pretty quickly. It's a small area. It's got a wonderful view, but it can oftentimes described as a good-sized closet. So you work for hours and hours with somebody that physically close to them. You get a pretty good sense of their personality quite quickly.
We're talking with John Cox, a retired pilot who writes the Ask the Captain column for USA Today, CEO of Safety Operating Systems. We want to hear from pilots and air crew today. What goes on inside the cockpit behind that locked door? 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. Let's start with Matt. Matt with us from Tucson.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Well, one of the things I wanted to bring up, and I'm sure John can speak to this, is that, you know, most of the major airlines have a program in place called professional standards, whereby crew members can bring in individuals. They're generally volunteers, but they're trained regarding how to deal with these kind of things before it gets to this disastrous point, hopefully. So if a crew member has a question about another crew member's capability or their behavior or how they're operating the aircraft, et cetera, they can go to professional standards and say, hey, I have this concern. It needs to be addressed. Let's do that.
That's presumably while the plane is still on the ground.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. This committee is usually run by the pilots union with management approval, and it's a professional fraternal organization that pilots use to basically keep an eye on each other.
Captain Cox?
Professional standards is a very, very important part. Pilots hold each other to a very high level of professionalism. Professional standards comes in if there's a recurring problem with the way someone is handling an airplane or is being overly authoritarian or a variety of things where the ability to function cohesively as a crew in compliance with the standard operating procedures, those are the kinds of things that that get brought up to professional standards typically. We don't know in this case if there was any indication before yesterday that this captain had any issues or not, and I would be very hesitant until we learn a little bit more about the previous events, if any, that whether professional standards would have been involved or not.
Thanks very much for the call, Matt.
You bet.
Email from Pat in Gaston, Oregon. I was a Navy pilot and an airline pilot for 35 years. Generally, what goes on behind the door is boring and routine. Checklists are run, procedures are followed. For the most part, everything happens in an ordinary way. A lot of pilots' training is learning how to deal with the routine and remain alert and vigilant rather than becoming complacent. When a problem occurs, all those hours of training kick in. Often a checklist is run and procedures are followed, and the problem is fixed almost before you realize you've done it. It's the weird problems, like the JetBlue incident, that really can't be neatly boxed and fixed. That's where experience and common sense make a difference, and as the saying goes, that's why they get paid the big bucks.
I think I would agree with those sentiments. The training is very rigid. The training is extensive. It's ongoing. It proceduralizes a lot of things to happen that may happen with an abnormality, an engine that doesn't work well, a pressurization problem. All of those things are proceduralized. But in addition, you also have to be able to deal with the unexpected abnormality. And that's where the crew resource management comes in. That's where this type of training, this teamwork training comes in. There are times when you do have to be creative. It is very rare. But and it is all part of the overall training that airline crews, professional pilot crews go through.
I was just going to ask. I mean, obviously, pilots and first officers train on simulators. Are there simulated problems thrown at them that get them a chance to exercise that creativity and think their way through?
Absolutely. One of the somewhat well-known ones is either a captain or a first officer in the midst of a simulated, very low visibility approach, the weather's bad, the wind's blowing, it's turbulent, will just cease to function. And the flying pilot is then required to recognize that you have an incapacitation event, ensure that the pilot that is acting the incapacitated can't create a problem for the airplane and successfully either complete the landing or make the missed approach, swing back around, and set the approach up again. But there are training for incapacitated crew members.
And I know that on naval vessels, there is a formal procedure by which the first officer relieves the captain of command in such situations when that's necessary. Again, those rare moments. Is there a formal procedure for a first officer to relieve a captain on an airliner?
I don't know that I have ever seen it written, and as you described, for a naval situation, but there are cases where if any crew member has significant doubt about the ability of another crew member to function in their capacity, you bring it up to them, and if you may end up having to overrule it and say, okay, the crew believes that you're not capable of continuing, so you're not going to be in that position any longer, be it whether it's a flight attendant, whether it's a first officer, whether it's a captain, all of that all comes in together. So it's all crew incapacitation and utilizing the team to effectively ensure the safety of the flight.
Captain John Cox, a retired pilot, also writes the Ask the Captain column for USA Today. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go next to, this is Steve. Steve with us from Norman, Oklahoma.
Hello.
Hi, Steve. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hey, good. I was just going to mention for historical context, FedEx Flight 705, April 7, 1994, there was a crew member, a jump-seating crew member, who attacked the three operating crew members. It was David Sanders, the captain, James Tucker, the first officer, Andrew Peterson, the flight engineer. This is on a FedEx DC-10, and they had to fight for their lives for control of that airplane. Auburn Calloway wanted to commit suicide by flying this airplane into the FedEx Memphis Worldwide Hub, and that was about as bad as it gets. He attacked them with a ball-peen hammer in the cockpit. A fight ensued. Fortunately, they were able to regain control of the cockpit.
Wow, Captain Cox, do you remember that?
Oh, yeah, I remember the situation very well. Mr. Calloway was, I think, had faced disciplinary issues with the airline previously, and I'm not even sure how much longer he would have been employed with them. But, you know, that was a very tragic event for a whole variety of things. That flight crew, that FedEx flight crew, did a remarkable job in defending themselves and keeping the airplane safe until they could subdue Mr. Calloway and then complete the landing.
Steve, thanks very much for the reminder. Appreciate it.
All right.
Let's go next to this is Tim, and Tim with us from Park City, Utah.
Hi there. How you doing?
Good, thanks.
I'm a pilot for a regional airline, and I think that the biggest part of the story is how that first officer both recognized that the captain was freaking out and then had a plan to get him out of the cockpit without having a catastrophic fight a la that FedEx situation in the cockpit.
We don't know what happened in that cockpit. Would it have been recorded? Obviously, there's a sound recorder. Would it have picked that up?
Yeah, definitely. The intercom's recorded, and there's also an area microphone that picks up, you know, the noise in the general area of the cabin. I just was thinking about, you know, if he had totally freaked out up there, and there's a lot of buttons you can push, and if the guy's trying to fight you while you try to push him back and rectify the situation, I don't know if that's a situation where you could really successfully have a good, successful outcome there.
Captain Cox.
I think this first officer certainly needs to be commended. He handled it in a way that minimized the force or minimized the likelihood of there being a situation while the captain was acting in a way that was not consistent with safe flight. So he was able to use quick thinking and then building the team with the flight attendants. Once he was able to get the captain out of the flight deck, then was able to ensure that he wouldn't get back in. So this is an individual who thought well under pressure, and that's one of the things pilots are taught to do from the very first basic flight training, is you have to be able to think under pressure. And this first officer did a very good job of it by persuading the captain that he needed to go to the lavatory, he needed to get out of the flight deck, and then taking very significant and direct moves to ensure that the captain was not going to get back in. So I commend him for it.
It had to be the most unusual announcement he will ever make over a plane's PA system, though.
I think so. I think that it's clearly one that everyone will remember. But I think that this first officer, he really does deserve commendation for his actions. It was a good job.
The rest of the air crew as well, and certainly the passengers who came to their aid as well in restraining the captain. And we certainly wish him the best of luck and hope he recovers. Tim, would it cause you to take another look at the person across from you in the cockpit?
You know, I'm going to work here in a few minutes, and I'm trying to think of a funny joke to tell the captain to freak out on me. But we really do a lot of self-checking, and the pilot incapacitation, like Captain Cox was talking about, is something we think about. And there's a continual evaluation. You know, my company has it's the three-comment rule, or some people have the two-comment rule. If they don't respond to you immediately after, you know, hey, the third time, that's it. You know, you're out for the flight. And the book does say keep the pilot away from the controls, but I never thought it would be, I always thought it would be someone slumped over, not someone actively being combative in the cockpit.
Have a safe flight, Tim.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for the call. And Captain Cox, thank you for your time.
My pleasure, Neil. Good to talk to you again.
John Cox, CEO of Safety Operating Systems and author of the Ask the Captain column for USA Today. This is the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.